All right, we are ready to go here. This is a continuing series of sessions in a class on Christian Apologetics Methods for Reclaiming the Mind Ministries as part of their theology program. And this course is based on a book that I co-authored called Faith Has Its Reasons, which I co-authored with a friend of mine, Ken Boa, B-O-A. And if you do not have a copy of that book, I hope that you'll get it and that you'll get a chance to read that, because a lot of what we're talking about will be easier to digest and to really get your mind comfortable with if you're reading it as well as hearing about it and hopefully talking about it. Toward the end of this class session, we'll allow some time for any comments or questions that you might have. But let's go ahead and get started here. This is part two of our discussion on evidentialism. Evidentialism is a term that needs to be defined, and although we did some introductory analysis of evidentialism and how it compares to classical apologetics last time, there is a matter of definition that needs to be addressed rather directly and specifically in order to avoid a certain confusion that comes up in relation to other approaches to apologetics which have certain objections to something they call evidentialism, which turns out to be not exactly the same thing as evidentialism traditionally in what is known as Christian apologetics. So I need to distinguish two kinds of evidentialism. The first is epistemological evidentialism. Now, epistemological is a term that simply means referring to knowledge, to how we know what we know, or how we justify or demonstrate the validity of what we know intelligibly or reasonably. So epistemology is concerned with not the psychology of how we came to know something, although that may have some bearing, but it has to do with philosophically how do we know that anything that we think that we know is really so and is something that we can call knowledge and not just opinion or our own personal guess or preference or feeling. So epistemological evidentialism is a particular view of what it takes to justify or warrant or support or make valid a claim to knowledge. I've used several different terms there. Those of you who have background in philosophy will know why I did that. Those of you who don't have a lot of background in philosophy don't need to worry about that, but it's simply a matter of recognizing that there are different ways of approaching this issue of what do you mean you know something? And different philosophers have different answers to even what that means to claim that you know something. Well, epistemological evidentialism says that you really can't claim to know something unless you have sufficient evidence to back it up. Let me repeat that. Epistemological evidentialism claims that you really cannot claim to know something unless you have sufficient evidence to back it up. Now, the classic statement of epistemological evidentialism came from an early 20th century author, W.K. Clifford. And let me see if I can give you the exact information on Mr. Clifford, because he's an interesting figure, a minor figure to some extent in the history of philosophy, but nevertheless an interesting figure. His name is W.K. Clifford. And basically what Clifford said, and I'm going to give you an exact quotation here in just a second. I mean, again, trying to give you the date for this. because I think you might find that worthy of note of noting. Clifford actually is a late 19th century, not early 20th century, so I correct myself here. And he said this in an article that was first published in 1877. All right, so that's how far back it goes. I'm glad I corrected myself there. 1877, W.K. Clifford wrote this. It is wrong everywhere, always, and for anyone to believe anything upon insufficient evidence. Let me read that quotation again. It is wrong everywhere, always, and for anyone to believe anything upon insufficient evidence. End of quote. This has become known in the history of philosophy as Clifford's Maxim, and it is a very pithy and very blunt affirmation of this principle of epistemological evidentialism. Now, in the late 20th century, some philosophers, primarily Christian philosophers, began challenging and, let me just say, attacking this epistemological evidentialist principle. They argued that epistemological evidentialism is itself a victim of its own its own epistemological arrogance, and let me explain why. Again, Clifford said, it is wrong everywhere, always, and for anyone to believe anything upon insufficient evidence. Now, what these Christian philosophers, and we'll talk more about these when we get into Reformed apologetics, because some of them were and are in the Reformed theological tradition. What these philosophers pointed out, first of all, is that Clifford gave no evidence in support of this principle. Now, this ought to be familiar to you from our discussion of classical apologetics, because the classical apologists will often answer a particular claim by pointing out that it is self-defeating or self-refuting. Well, this is a similar point. The epistemological evidentialist principle or maxim that you can't believe anything unless you have sufficient evidence for it is itself something for which it's difficult to know what sort of evidence you would specify in its support. How do you know that it's wrong everywhere, always, and for anyone to believe anything upon insufficient evidence? How do you know that, Mr. Clifford? What is your evidence in support of that claim? Well, as you can see, there's a difficulty there, and perhaps an evidentialist who subscribes to this particular claim, this particular maxim, might be prepared to offer some evidence in support of this principle, but I think it would be very difficult. So that's the first problem, is that it asks us to believe something that it doesn't present enough evidence for, or sufficient evidence for, or maybe even any evidence for, and therefore is a self-defeating principle. Like the claim that we talked about before, everything is relative. Well, if everything is relative, then the statement everything is relative is also relative, which means it's not always true that it's relative, so sometimes there are absolute truths. Well, if there is at least one thing that it is legitimate to believe without being able to offer sufficient evidence for it, without having evidence to back it up, then the evidentialist principle in epistemology falls. Now, the other point that was made is that Clifford's maxim puts a burden of proof on every belief. And this creates what might be described as an epistemology of suspicion. In other words, everything that people believe, we're going to suspect is not true. Now, this is a this is actually a tried and true, I don't know if it's true, but it's been a tried philosophical approach in the Western philosophy long before W.K. Clifford. The approach in Western philosophy of trying to get down to irrefutable, undoubtable, absolute knowledge that could not possibly be false, that could not possibly even be doubted, that you have absolute certainty about it. This is something that Westerners have been looking for a very long time. And it goes back at least to René Descartes, the French philosopher, who is famous for practically nothing except his very famous statement, "I think, therefore I am." What is the point of that? Now, many people do not know what the point of that is. The point of that is Descartes is trying to present an argument that cannot be refuted by engaging in a kind of thought experiment. Suppose that I doubt everything that I possibly can. Suppose I doubt my senses. I doubt that there is a table in front of me. I doubt the physical reality that I, you know, that is around me, that is in me, and that I encounter at every step. To give a modern example of this, suppose I imagine that I am actually in the Matrix and that nothing is around me is real. Even my body is not real. I'm actually, something entirely different, or at least very different than what I feel like I am, or I'm in a very different environment than what it seems that I am in. The Matrix raises this epistemological question. How do we know that anything is true? How do we know that, is it possible that everything around us is a lie, is an illusion? Well, Descartes asked the same question. He said, suppose I were to doubt everything, including my senses. He said, there's one thing I can't doubt, which is that I am actually doubting. In the process of doubting, I realize that I am thinking something. I am thinking about whether I can believe anything that I actually believe. And so, in doubting, I realize I am thinking. In realizing that I am thinking, I realize that I must be here in order to be doing the thinking. Whatever I am, I mean, maybe there's questions about what I am, but that I exist cannot be doubted, because somebody has to be here to be doing the doubting. And so really, Descartes' statement, "I think, therefore I am," might be better paraphrased in context to give the flavor. I doubt, therefore I am. I have doubts, but nevertheless, the very fact that I can doubt, that I am here doubting right now, proves that I am. At least to himself. It might not prove it to you. You know, if I tell you, "I think, therefore I am," you might say, "Well, I don't know about you. I don't know if you're real. Maybe you're an illusion, but I know I'm real." And so that's Descartes' attempt to establish a premise on which a philosophical investigation of reality could be launched from a secure platform that could not possibly be doubted, that could not possibly be shifted or challenged. The starting point that I know that I exist, I know that I am a thinking being of some kind, and I can start from there. Well, that desire to find something that is absolutely secure, irrefutable, unchallengeable starting point, that's very typical of the Western philosophical tradition. And when that could not be done in terms of pure logic, in terms of pure rationality, or in terms of pure deductive reason, then those of a more empirical mindset, like W.K. Clifford, said, "All right, fine. We may not be able to have an absolutely irrefutable starting point for a logical argument, but we ought not to believe anything unless we have sufficient factual, empirical evidence to back it up. And so we're not going to believe anything unless we can amass enough evidence to show that our belief is well justified in terms of factual support. Now, as I point out, the big problem with that is that you can't adjudicate epistemological assumptions like that on the basis of any evidence. Another problem is, who's to say how much evidence is enough? Are we going to approach every assertion of fact, every statement of empirical observation as under suspicion, under a cloud of doubt, and subject to disbelief until we are forced somehow by enough evidence, whatever enough evidence means, that we really have to give in and cry uncle and conclude, all right, I guess that's probably true. And you see, this is what the Western mind has done. We couldn't get away with that just using deductive reasoning alone, so now we're trying to do the same thing in the 19th century with empirical factual evidence. I've got to be convinced by a mass of evidence that's just going to overwhelm me, and you're going to have to show me factually that this is the case, and you're going to have to close every possible loophole until I cry uncle and admit, yeah, I guess that's probably true. So this is, as you can see, even though it's a shift from the deductive model of an approach to reason to a more inductive and empirical approach, it's still operating from the same sort of guiding light of wanting to have as much certainty as possible, wanting to, and approaching things, truth claims with suspicion. I've got to be shown that this is the case. You've got to prove it to me. We're all from Missouri. you got to show me. All right, so these philosophers that I have mentioned, and I haven't even said their names, but the best known one would be Alvin Plantinga, have turned the tables on epistemological evidentialism and said, you know what, there are some things that we rightly believe and we don't have any evidence for them at all. Or we might or might not have evidence for them, but it's perfectly reasonable to believe them, and we don't have to be able to prove them. We don't have to be able to cite evidence or factual support for them. You can just know something. And rather than operating from an epistemology of suspicion, we should operate from an epistemology of that's you could call epistemology of credulity. We're going to believe something unless we have a reason not to. Now notice the contrast here. Epistemological evidentialism says we ought not to believe something unless we have to, or the evidence really pushes us to have to admit that this probably is the case. The other point of view, which Plantinga represents, is if you believe something, you're fine, and you should go on believing it unless somebody gives you a good reason not to believe it. And you can see that there's quite a difference there in these approaches. Well, we'll talk a lot more about Plantinga in the next 2 weeks, but just to introduce that as sort of a preview of coming attractions, that this is going to become a significant issue in Christian apologetics from another perspective that we'll be examining in the next 2 weeks. So epistemological evidentialism is an approach to knowledge which is suspicious of any truth claim and puts the burden of proof on any truth claim and says, I don't have a right to believe this unless I have evidence to back it up. Now, are evidentialists in Christian apologetics epistemological evidentialists? Well, usually the answer to that is no. They're usually not epistemological evidentialists. They usually do not claim that you are not within your epistemic rights to believe something unless you've got evidence to back it up. They do, however, think that we shouldn't be going around telling other people that they need to believe something without giving them some kind of evidence in support of that belief. So they would perhaps rewrite Clifford's maxim to say, it is wrong everywhere, always, and for anyone to tell someone else to believe anything upon insufficient evidence. Or perhaps, because the issue of sufficiency here is nebulous, to tell anyone else to believe something without any evidence at all. In other words, there's a responsibility on the part of the apologist to give evidence, to give factual support, to give a reason for why we believe what we believe. So apologetic evidentialism is not the same thing as epistemological evidentialism. And evidentialists in apologetics are not saying that it's unreasonable to believe something unless you can bring forth or specify evidence in its support. What the evidentialist in apologetics is saying is we have a responsibility to provide factual support for the Christian faith. And in fact, one of the beauties of Christianity, according to evidentialists, is we actually have such evidential support. It's not that you have to have evidence for everything that you believe, but it turns out Christianity is superior to other religions in that it has a paper trail of evidence that shows that its truth claims are grounded in fact. This is typified, perhaps, in the title of one of John Warwick Montgomery's best-known books, Faith Founded on Fact. Faith Founded on Fact. That what separates Christianity from other religions is that it is based on fact and not on wish fulfillment or guesswork or just personal whim, private experience, but it's based on fact that is empirical, that is out there, that can be examined, and that's what we're talking about here. Now, evidentialists, and from now on, when I talk about evidentialists, I'm going to be talking about evidentialists in apologetics, not epistemological evidentialists. Evidentialists believe that classical apologetics, in its emphasis on logic and logical demonstration, are not giving a sufficient apologetic for Christianity in some respects. And now there's not a real strong, vehement clash between evidentialists and classical apologists, so I don't want to make this sound bigger than it is. But evidentialists believe that the classical approach needs a little bit of fine-tuning or a little bit of an adjustment in that it a rational deductive or primarily deductive approach to defending Christian faith has some deficiencies or weaknesses from the evidentialist point of view. I'm just a second here. If you get into the discussions in the literature between the classical apologists and the evidentialists in sufficient depth, you will find that there is some disagreement about apologetic method. And at the crux of it is the belief on the part of the evidentialists that logic is just not enough. That logic, all you can do with logic is to show that a worldview is either possibly true or definitely false, but you can't show that it is true. That logic, all logic can do is show that a particular worldview or a particular belief system is coherent. But according to the evidentialists, it is possible to have competing worldviews, competing belief systems that are both logically coherent. Now, here is where somebody like Norman Geisler and somebody like John Warwick Montgomery might get into a bit of a disagreement, at least to some extent, because Geisler is going to argue that Christianity is the only perfectly coherent worldview as long as he's allowed to introduce some very basic reality component to the argument. He admits and acknowledges, admits is really not a fair term, he acknowledges that if all you had was logic, then the evidentialists would be right. But he is going to argue that with a minimal acknowledgement of the reality that something exists, you can develop a worldview that in the end shows that God exists and that theism is the correct worldview. The evidentialists, like John Warwick Montgomery, are going to argue that this kind of rational, deductive building up of an argument for Christian theism, or even just for a generic theism, with a minimal of introduction of factual support, is a weak approach. That there are too many holes in these arguments, that they're too abstract, and that in the end, you really cannot avoid the problem of competing worldviews being equally coherent, just having a different view of the world. And so what Montgomery and other evidentialists have argued is that coherence being at best a negative test for truth. In other words, if a worldview is incoherent, obviously... Okay, here we go. This is the second installment here of our class on part two on evidentialism. And we've been talking about the application of C. Bion McCullough's criteria of historical explanation to the question of the resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead. And we've already mentioned explanatory scope. Explanatory scope, again, just to review quickly, is the criterion that, all other things being equal, the explanation that accounts for the most evidence, for the most facts, is the better explanation. So if you have five facts that you want to explain, and one theory explains four, and the other theory explains two, the one that explains four is the better theory. The second criterion is the criterion of explanatory power. Now, explanatory power is not the same thing as explanatory scope. Explanatory power has to do with how well the theory accounts for the facts. You could have two theories that claim to account for the same fact, but one accounts for that fact in a nicer way, a much more comfortable way. It explains it more satisfactorily in some way. Now, you could probably tell that explanatory power could be subject to more interpretation, subject to more variance in terms of how one assesses whether a particular theory has explanatory power, rather than simply being a possible explanation, being an explanation that easily accounts for the evidence. But nevertheless, this is a widely recognized, widely used criterion for any kind of empirical investigation, be it history, be it in law, which of course actually is a kind of historical inquiry because you're trying to find out what happened in the past, be it science, explanatory power is a very important criterion. You've got two facts and one explanation fits that fact better than the other. Well, then you're going to go with the explanation that best fits the fact that you've got. Could be in a particular court case, let's say you've got an individual who is suspected of being the murder victim, and the victim's blood is found on his shoe. At least it looks like it's his shoe. It was in his room. It's his size. It has his initials written into the inside of the shoe. It certainly looks like it's his shoe. Now, are there other possible explanations? Yes. Perhaps somebody else with the same initials and the same shoe size happened to be in the murderer's, the accused bedroom, and left his shoe there. That's not a very likely explanation, but it's a possible one. Both theories have the same explanatory scope. They both explain the same evidence, but one explains it a lot better, frankly, than the other. Well, that's what we mean by explanatory power. How well does it account for the fact? How well does it account for the evidence? Now, a third criterion, and some of these criteria arguably overlap one another. So I just want to acknowledge that, and if you're really persnickety about this, really wanting to get this nailed down as neatly as possible, you might find that some of these overlap. So I just want to acknowledge that. But a third criterion that McCullough separates out from these first two, and that many people would cite as a specific third criterion, is that the best explanation is the one that, or the better explanation is the one that is less ad hoc. Less ad hoc. Now, what does ad hoc mean? Well, it's one of these Latin expressions that people use quite often, and you need to know it, if at all possible, because it's one that is a very useful concept. A particular explanation is said to be ad hoc if the only basis for the explanation is to save a particular theory, or is because it's consistent with what you've already decided is the case. Exactly. It's an attempt to rescue the argument by coming up with some kind of an explanation. You don't have any evidence for your explanation except that it happens to fit your theory. So to accuse someone's argument of being ad hoc, or their explanation of being ad hoc, is essentially to accuse them of intellectual desperation. We've got to save the theory. We are embarrassed by the facts, but aha! We have an explanation for this pesky fact that got in the way of our theory. We don't have any independent evidence in support of this cute little explanation. But, hey, it saves the theory, and it's possible. And so we're going to seize upon this particular sort of side argument or side explanation to save our big explanation or our big theory. We will introduce this little side explanation for which we have absolutely no evidence. But hey, you know, you can't say it couldn't have happened. Now, we talked about this. I don't know that I used the term ad hoc in this context, but we talked about a situation where this arose in a previous week. In fact, last week, when I talked about the rise of modern science and the downfall of the geocentric worldview, which says that all the heavenly bodies move in perfect circles around the Earth. And I pointed out that there was this problem of the planets. The planets, the term planet means wanderer, and the planets do not move in perfect circles in the night sky. They, if you track the motion of a planet over a period of several months, or a year, or a year and a half, and so forth, what you'll find is that the planet will tick across the sky from night to night in a slightly different position. It'll tick across the sky in one direction for a while, and then it will start to make kind of a loop-de-loop in the sky. It'll backtrack up and or down and around and then move ahead back in the same path that it was apparently going before in the night sky. And you have to look at this over a period of several months to see this. And you can actually do this. You can go out in the night at nighttime, and if you've got a clear sky, you can go look at Mars, and you can watch Mars and Jupiter as well do this. If you wanted to watch Jupiter do this, a telescope would be handy. But you can do this. You can watch this and you see it. It doesn't move in a perfect line, straight line in the night sky. It moves in this loop-de-loop. And so the defenders of the geocentric worldview said, well, the Mars is moving in a perfect circle around the Earth, but it's also moving in a perfect circle around its own orbit around the Earth. Well, what evidence did they have that it was moving in a perfect circle around its own orbit? None. It was an attempt to explain the evidence in the teeth of a bit of contrary evidence, really, to their pet theory. And so to save the geocentric worldview, the geocentric system, they had to introduce these circles around the circles, which were called epicycles. And then it turned out that the more they closely examined the tracking of the planets, that they even an epicycle wasn't good enough. So you ended up having epicycles around epicycles, and that just gets crazy, right? Well, this is what is known as an ad hoc explanation. When you come up with something that's really sort of out in left field, excuse me, there's really no good independent factual support for it, but it's necessary to make your grand theory hold up in the face of what appears to be contrary evidence. So McCullough says, the less ad hoc your explanation is, the better. The less you have to resort to these kind of sidebar explanations for things that don't really fit nicely with your theory. The less you have to do that, the better. You could see why that would make sense. We don't want to embarrass ourselves by adhering to a theory that requires all sorts of provisos and exception clauses and, various sidebar explanations that we don't have any evidence to support. All right, so the less ad hoc, the better. And the fourth criterion that I'll mention here is that we want the theory to have what is called plausibility. Now, here is where we get into some real difficulties, because defining plausibility turns out to be something of an academic game. There seems to be a lot of confusion, for example, in the literature of the philosophy of history as to what we mean by plausibility. Now, I'll just mention a couple of ways that people have gone at this. One is to say a particular theory is plausible if it fits with everything else that we know about the world. If this particular theory fits our general worldview, then it's plausible. Well, if it has to fit the worldview in order to be plausible, then, for example, you couldn't have a supernatural explanation be plausible unless you had first established the existence of a supernatural being. And so here's where the classical apologists would say, hold on there, you cannot show that the resurrection is plausible unless you've established theism first, because you first got to show that there is a God who could do miracles before you can show that a specific miracle is plausible. It isn't plausible unless you have a worldview context in which it could have happened. Now, evidentialists are quite aware of this objection, and they tend to define plausibility, at least in this context, they tend to define plausibility as fitting with our background knowledge, where background knowledge is more focused specifically on the context in which the event or fact in question, facts in question, need to be situated. So, for example, if the resurrection of Jesus occurs in a context historically in which everything else that we can find out about Jesus, about his historical life, about the things that happened with him and so forth, is consistent with his having resurrected from the dead, well then, that lends a greater degree of plausibility to the resurrection than if this were simply a kind of Ripley's Believe It or Not story where, you know, somebody was reported to have died and then people said that they saw him alive after his death, and we really don't know why that would happen. And this would be, for example, you see these reports in the National Enquirer or other kinds of news papers that are, if you want to call them that, that are at the grocery checkout where, somebody says that they saw Elvis alive in a grocery store in Montana or something. Well, does that really fit with anything that we know about Elvis in terms of his own life? There is a question as to what we mean by plausibility. Now, one more criterion that I think I'll mention here, because it is potentially important in some contexts, is that of predictive power. I talked about explanatory power. Predictive power is the ability of an explanation to anticipate evidence that is discovered after the theory is proposed. We're most familiar with this in science. The scientist says, I have a theory. I'm now going to test it by running some experiments to see if the evidence will support my theory. My theory is, that this particular pharmaceutical will clear up a skin rash. I'm going to apply this pharmaceutical to the skin rash on several different monkeys and see if it clears up the skin rash. By golly, it did. That's predictive power. Predictive power is the ability of an explanation or the ability of a description or a theory to anticipate future discoveries, to anticipate evidence not yet found. Well, you could have this in history as well. You could say, I've examined the evidence that we have, and I have a theory as to the location of a particular site mentioned in the Bible. Perhaps, town mentioned in the Old Testament. No one knows exactly where that town is. So you read everything in the text that you can on it. You find out as best you can where it would probably be based on what the text says. You come up with the theory, okay, I believe this is where the town was located. You go and you do a little archaeological dig, and by golly, there it is, you know. So your theory has explanatory scope and power because it accounts for all the evidence, but it also has predictive power because it enables you to find something you would not have found otherwise. It helps you to actually run down new evidence. Well, you could see that if a theory had predictive power, it would enhance its credibility in comparison to theories that did not have predictive power. All right, now, McCullough himself, in his book Justifying Historical Descriptions, asks the interesting question here. How does the resurrection of Jesus stand up in light of these criteria? And McCullough has an interesting take on this. It's not the one that is taken by evangelical apologists. McCullough argues that the resurrection of Jesus as an historical explanation has explanatory scope and power, but does not have plausibility. And he also says it is more ad hoc than other explanations. Now, I frankly disagree with him flat out as to it being more ad hoc than other explanations, but I'm not sure I really understand why he drew that conclusion. But he acknowledges that the resurrection has a significant explanatory scope and power. If those were the only two criteria, it would be the best explanation. But he thinks it's lacking in plausibility and that it's more ad hoc than other explanations. I believe that this would be a case where an historian thinks that any supernatural explanation is more ad hoc than a natural one. And there are people that take that view. I disagree with it, but there are also those who take the view that any supernatural explanation is less plausible than any natural explanation. I'll give you an illustration of this. Robert Greg Cavin, C-A-V-I-N. Greg Cavin is a professor of philosophy. He's a professional philosopher. His PhD dissertation, which I believe was at University of California, Irvine, was on the subject of miracles as explanations, and specifically on the resurrection. And in this particular dissertation, Dr. Cavin argued that any natural explanation, no matter how ad hoc, no matter how far-fetched, as long as it had explanatory scope and power, that any natural explanation of the facts was epistemologically superior to any supernatural explanation, which by definition would be the least plausible kind of explanation you could have. And therefore, according to Cavin, even a ridiculously far-fetched naturalistic explanation of the evidence is preferred, is preferable to the explanation that Jesus rose from the dead. What's Cavin's explanation? Cavin's explanation is Jesus had an identical twin. He was born to another mother, not Mary, along with his identical twin. Jesus and Mary's actual child were switched at birth. I'm not making this up, okay? Don't blame me for this now. This is Cavin's explanation. Jesus and Mary's biological child were switched at birth. I guess the tags got mixed up in the hospital. I don't know here. So Mary goes off with Jesus, thinking that Jesus is her child. Jesus' identical twin brother is someone unknown to him throughout his lifetime. The twin does not know Jesus. Jesus does not know the twin because they were separated at birth. Flash forward now to AD 30, 33, whatever date you have for the crucifixion of Jesus. Jesus is being crucified by Pontius Pilate. The identical twin, and Bill Craig, William Lane Craig, dubs this the Dave theory. Dave is based on the movie Dave, in which a guy named Dave turns out to be a doppelganger, and a guy that looks exactly like the President of the United States, and he gets switched with the President. It's a comedy. Anyway, so Dave wanders into Jerusalem and observes that his guy that looks just like him is being crucified. He says, "Oh my goodness, that's my twin brother. We always wondered why my brother didn't look anything like me. Well, now I know. This is my actual twin." And so he observes that Jesus gets crucified. He finds out he's heard about Jesus. He had no idea that he was related to him. Turns out he's his identical twin. So then after Jesus is crucified, Dave steals the body from the tomb. Reburies it somewhere so nobody ever finds it. Then passes himself off to Jesus' disciples as Jesus come back from the dead. Convinces them that he's resurrected from the dead. Now, Greg Cavan says, this has explanatory scope and power. It explains all the evidence and explains it just as well as the resurrection hypothesis. But it's ridiculously more ad hoc. He admits the theory is crazy in that it's all these things that we have no evidence that Jesus had an identical twin or that there was a separation at birth and all the rest of that stuff. He admits it's way ad hoc. But because it's a natural explanation, it is instantly superior to any supernatural explanation by such a margin that it doesn't matter that the theory is ad hoc. You could see that people apply these criteria in different ways and reach different conclusions as to whether or not the best explanation is that Jesus rose from the dead. A lot hangs on what you mean by plausibility, what kinds of assumptions you bring to the table as to what counts as a plausible explanation. If you assume a even just methodologically, a naturalistic perspective, that the explanation needs to be a natural one, then if you make that assumption, then the miraculous explanation that God raised Jesus from the dead is going to be put in last place as an explanation, no matter how much evidence there is in favor of it. And so there's an obvious tussle here among scholars as they look at the evidence for the resurrection as to whether it can be used to show that Jesus rose from the dead. Most biblical scholars acknowledge the same basic facts, that Jesus died on the Roman cross, that he was buried somewhere, although they may or may not agree that he was buried in Joseph of Arimathea's tomb, but most of them agree that he was buried. And I would say an awful lot of them agree that it might as well have been in Joseph's tomb. Most of them acknowledge that Jesus' immediate followers, his disciples, including women and men, had experiences that they believed were appearances of a resurrected Jesus. So these facts are considered by most biblical scholars to be in evidence. However, The non-Christian and liberal critics and biblical scholars object to concluding that Jesus rose from the dead as an historical explanation on the grounds that historical explanations need to be natural. And so this turns out to be sort of the bottom line argument when it comes to applying these historical criteria of explanation to a question like the resurrection of Jesus. All right, we've had several hiccups here in the lecture because of some technical difficulties, but we do have a little bit of time left, so I would like to find out if you have any questions, perhaps comments on things that have been said. I would like to, you can type out your question.